KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. You might want to put down that California sushi roll for this conversation. This hour, we talk about slavery in the international fish supply chain. The Associated Press reports men from Burma, Cambodia, and Thailand are tricked or kidnapped by Thai traffickers and forced to fish day and night on trawlers far off the coast in Southeast Asia. That fish finds its way here to the U.S., to supermarkets and restaurants and pet stores. We'll assess what's going on and what can be done to stop it in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. Over the years, reports have trickled out from Southeast Asia about human trafficking in the fish business. This week, the Associated Press released another damning report that not only details 19th century style abuse on fishing trawlers, but tracks some of the fish they caught through processing facilities and then here to the U.S., to our lunch trays and dinner tables and pet food bowls. We have joining us today in studio Martha Mendoza, I should say, from the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz. She is the co-author of the Associated Press investigation. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks.
We have Paul Greenberg on the line, writer, journalist, and author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood.
Thanks for having me on.
And last but not least, Jackie Savitz of Oceana, an international oceans preservation organization in Washington, D.C. Jackie leads their work in the U.S. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Martha Mendoza, why don't we start with you? Can you tell us what inspired this investigation?
Sure. As you mentioned, there were previous reports of migrant abuses in the seafood industry in Southeast Asia. And so my colleagues in Myanmar were working on a story about looking for this. And they heard that there were some people working in remote island reaches of Indonesia. What they found were slaves. They came ashore and found that these men were being forced to fish at sea. And when their boats docked, those whose captains thought they might run away were locking them in a cage. And they talked to more than 40 current and former slaves who described working up to 22 hours in a single stretch, months at sea. They described being beaten. They said many are killed. And bodies now end up in this graveyard on the island where they're buried under false names.
Is it just the one island, or do you have a sense that there's an entire system of slavery in the seas of Southeast Asia?
This morning, the International Organization for Migration said that there's at least 4,000 fishermen stranded on some of Indonesia's remotest islands, and most of these men have been abandoned by unscrupulous fishing boat operators who are responding to a new Indonesian government moratorium on, you know, illegal take and unfair labor practices, et cetera. And so they're looking at about 4,000 right now.
We'll take up that moratorium in just a moment. But the Associated Press also decided to track the fish, and I'm wondering if you can talk about that.
Yeah, when my colleagues contacted me and said, you know, you wouldn't believe it, what we found, I said, well, we have to get these men free, and we have to follow the fish. And so we contacted the International Organization for Migration about getting the men who we had talked to freed, because we were very concerned about their safety, having come forward and been willing to speak with us on camera. And then the second thing we did, was follow the fish. And this was something that just hasn't been done. We watched them and videotaped them loading from the smaller boats out at sea onto a large refrigerated cargo shipment. We satellite tracked that shipment for 15 days into a port in Thailand. And then in Thailand, staked out this boat as it came into shore, and for 4 nights watched it unload more than 150 trucks and followed those trucks to processing plants, got the names of those processing plants, mostly from signs out in front of them, and then went back to them and interviewed them to find out where their seafood goes. We also used U.S. customs records that identify those plants and shipments from those plants to U.S. companies. And those customs records also, in some cases, have a brand on them, a brand name. So in the end, we found that this fish can wind up in the supply chains of America's major grocery stores, Kroger, Albertsons, Safeway, the nation's largest retailer, Walmart, the biggest food distributor, Sysco, and that it's also finding its way into the supply chains of popular brands of canned pet food like Fancy Feast or Meow Mix or Iams. It can turn up at calamari at fine dining restaurants or, as you said at the top, imitation crab in a California sushi roll, or packages of frozen snapper relabeled with store brands that are on our dinner tables. So, yeah, at the end of the day, we found that we may all be eating their catch.
Now, a lot of the global food supply system relies on some fairly unconscionable labor conditions down at the bottom of the food chain, if you will. How did the AP determine that what you guys were seeing here in the waters off Indonesia constitutes slavery as just opposed to really terrible working conditions?
The State Department and the UN's definition of modern-day slavery is when somebody is forced to work. So even if somebody did sign up for the job and then realize they don't want it, it's still modern-day slavery. In this situation, it was far worse. They were literally being locked into cages.
Cages and then whipped with stingray tails. That was a detail that spoke out to me.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah, and the slaves said that they used to die at sea and they would just dump their bodies overboard. But at some point, the brokers and captains back on shore wanted the number of people accounted for. And so then they said that they would put the bodies into the refrigerated cargo areas of the boats with the fish and freeze them and bring them back into shore.
Oh, gosh. Wow. And, you know, here's the thing. There's so many people involved in the fish trade. You know, ships come back to these processing facilities. How is it that this situation exists without somebody saying something or, you know, calling the alarm or getting the various countries involved to take action?
I think that it has just not been a priority because this is not something that is coming as a total surprise to the experts or people who are familiar with this. I think that it just comes up now and then in a report, it's documented, and then it seems to go away. And that's why it was so critical to us to follow the fish so that we could track it back, not just, it, you know, Thai seafood is tainted with slavery, but this is reaching all of us. This impacts all of us.
Jackie Savitz, you're listening to Martha Mendoza's story. And as Martha says, we kind of know it's not a good situation there, and we've known that for years. What is happening as a result of this latest expose in the international political community?
Sure. Well, first let me say, you know, AP really deserves a lot of credit for this investigative journalism. It is, you know, almost unprecedented in recent times to have this type of exposure of an issue of this magnitude. So thank you, Martha, and for your team for doing this. You know, and I think, you know, to answer your question, I think part of the reason why this type of behavior continues is because of the great amount of secrecy that is still inherent in our seafood supply system. And, you know, that's a problem when it comes to illegal fishing. We know that, you know, that's a, you know, obviously a sort of secondary problem here, but it persists because of the secrecy, and we get a lack of enforcement from a lot of countries. There are some countries who do enforce their fishing rules and other ones who don't. And as long as that continues to be the case, and there's that secrecy there, we'll never really know what's happening on these vessels, and that's what needs to change.
Isn't there some system of labeling so that when I go to my local fish store or fish department at a supermarket, I can see this fish came from X country and, you know, was farmed or wild, frozen or not?
Yeah, there is a system that we can see the country of origin labeling, but as actually Paul Greenberg, who's on this call, has pointed out, it's not always that clear exactly what the full origin of the fish was and what the supply chain was that it followed. And that's why Oceana has been working really hard to try to get a system that we call traceability in place, where we would actually trace seafood from the boat to the plate through the supply chain, through the processors and the distributors and the landings at port and all the way to the restaurant or the grocery store, and they give consumers information so that they can see where their fish is coming from, how it's being caught. Is it being caught using humane technologies? Is it being caught, you know, hopefully not using slaves? And also, where is it being caught and when is it being caught? And when consumers have that kind of, if they're armed with that type of information and that information can be verified, then we can really use our sort of our marketing power to choose seafood from places where we know we don't have human rights abuses or we don't have illegal fishing.
Paul Greenberg, can you explain for us what the tracking and labeling system looks like today?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's important to step back and look at the just crazy nature of the seafood system that we're dealing with. And again, hats off to AP and Martha. Just, you know, as an independent writer, you did the legwork and put in the resources that were necessary to really get this story. So just incredible kudos. But to begin with, I mean, we have to remember that about 90% of the seafood that we eat in this country is imported. So when AP breaks this story, it's not just sort of a marginal thing. It's about our entire seafood supply. The other thing that goes on is that a certain amount of our seafood that we catch here in America, a lot of squid in California, a lot of salmon in Alaska, it's caught here, it's frozen, it's sent to Thailand or to China, defrosted, boned, repackaged, refrozen, and sent back to us double frozen. So all of these things that are going on, whether you have the fish being caught through illegal or slave labor conditions in the country of origin, it's all getting mixed in with some of the fish that's caught in a decent way in our country. So separating out, you know, what's what is extremely difficult. And I'm sure, you know, when AP looked into this, you know, you can say one thing, but when you actually sit down and track what's going in, what's going out, it becomes very, very difficult to say.
Paul Greenberg, where are the regulators in all of this? I mean, don't we have people whose job it is to be doing what Martha Mendoza and her colleagues did?
We do, but there's only so many, you know, hands and eyes that we are affording right now to put onto this. Only about 2% of American seafood gets any kind of inspection whatsoever. So it's fairly low priority. I will say, though, that last week the Obama administration, together with NOAA, put out a sort of fish fraud alert and a task force and an action plan to start getting things like the Department of Homeland Security involved and more government resources into checking the seafood supply chain and to understand where it's coming from and who caught it and how it was caught.
Is that going to be effective if the work they're doing is over here?
Well, you know, part of the regulatory structure is to have USDA inspectors overseas and working with partners in China and Thailand and all these places. We probably need to beef up the number of those people doing that inspection on the ground. And I should also say there are some sort of progressive companies out there that try to have traceability their responsibility. So I know the German company Natureland has been very much involved with this. World Wildlife Fund, a few years ago started something called the Aquaculture Dialogues, where they had industry leaders of the 8 or 9 biggest, most farmed fish out there have dialogues about trying to improve conditions throughout the supply chain, and one of the metrics in those aquaculture dialogues was labor practices. So there are people trying to do this, but it really needs to be ramped up.
Well, along those lines, Martha Mendoza, one of the many shocking details in your report involved those companies that actually make a point of trying to make sure their fish supply system is clean, got snared in this as well. It's not just, you know, pet food companies of dubious repute. There was Santa Monica Seafood, a Southern California seafood retail outlet and fish distributor. I mean, they have a reputation for trying very, very hard to do the right thing. How is it that they got caught up in this as well?
You know, I've gone back and forth on this a little bit. Santa Monica Seafood, yeah, they're a large independent importer that sells to restaurants, markets, direct from its store, and they really have been a leader in improving international fisheries. They send buyers around the world to inspect vendors. They were deeply disturbed when we approached them and told them what we had found, and they wanted details. They say they have zero tolerance for humanitarian abuses, and I believe them. On the other hand, this was an all-woman team of reporters. There were several who whose names didn't appear in the byline, who also worked on this, and a woman editor. And, you know, we're soccer moms and women who wanted to be writers, and we found this. And so I go both ways. I think that it is hard to find. It's very remote, and it's very hard to track. And as you just heard, seafood passes through many, many, many hands. It's a tough thing to trace, but I think the focus has been on whether they're being tricked into the wrong type of seafood. So they're being told that they're being sold a snapper and it's something else. And I think that they've been very focused on, was this sustainably harvested? Was this taken illegally from foreign water? And have not been focusing on the labor as much.
So I would jump in to say that, you know, about a third of the wild seafood that we import into this country appears to be coming to us through illegal or unregulated or unreported fishing or IUU fishing. So, you know, about a third. And I do think, haven't done the grand research to, you know, track A to B, but it seems to me that if you have people doing illegal fishing, they're probably good candidates for also having illegal labor practices.
Jackie Savitz, is it your sense that basically there are a lot of players in this global system that are willfully ignorant? They're either not asking questions or just choosing not to see what's fairly obvious in front of them.
You know, I think it really depends on who you're talking about. I think, for example, restaurateurs and chefs, you know, really do want to serve us quality products. They don't often have the capacity to do that because we don't have full chain traceability for seafood. But it's important to keep in mind the United States is the number one seafood importer in the world. Now, the European Union, of course, is bigger than the U.S. It's a series of countries. But between the two of us, we are a big part of the U.S. International seafood market. And so if we did put traceability in place and we required any importer to show us where they caught the fish, when they caught the fish, how they caught the fish, and the European Union did it too, it would make it really hard for these illegal fishing operations to stay in business. And I think it could severely affect the market for illegally caught fish. And as Paul says, there's probably a lot of overlap between illegal fishing practices and illegal labor practices as well.
But by definition, a lot of this fishing happens offshore, out of view of people who are, you know, sitting in offices on the coast. What's to stop a bunch of fishermen and fishing companies from falsifying the label so that it looks pretty for developed economies and their consumers?
Well, that's a really good question. That's something that we've asked ourselves a lot, and actually Oceana has teamed up with Google and another organization called SkyTruth to try to create a tool to allow us to verify the claims of fishing vessels who say, you know, I was fishing in a certain area at a certain time. We've developed a tool that can actually track global fishing and determine whether or not that vessel was really there. As long as it has, it's using a tracking system that's required of large vessels called AIS. And if they're not using it, then that's another reason why we might not want to be importing seafood from them. So in other words, if we made a rule that said, you got to tell us where you caught it and you got to have your AIS on so that we can verify it if you want to bring it into the United States, that could really curtail a lot of these problems.
I remember when I was working on American Catch and working with U.S. government statistics on trying to track how much was imported and how much was exported. And just on a basic data gathering level, it's extremely confusing because once a piece of fish comes into this country and gets processed here and then exported, it becomes a product of the United States. And likewise, if you have an American fish that goes to China and is processed there, it becomes a product of China. So disentangling that is really important just from a research point of view.
Paul Greenberg, something your reporting has turned up is that there just aren't the fish processing facilities domestically that would, you know, make it easier to sort of keep the industry over here so that we could more closely monitor it.
Yeah, I mean, as one Gloucester fisherman said to me, you know, you see fish processing houses turned into boutique hotels all the time, but you never see a boutique hotel turned into a fish processing plant. So there's this overall repurposing of the waterfront that has been happening on all of our coasts where, you know, increasingly we just sort of want to look out onto the water instead of having working waterfronts. Well, if you want to have fishermen, you've got to have someplace for them to unload and to process. And I think we might need to redefine what we think of as quaint when we look at the waterfront. I personally like a working waterfront, and I would like to see more processing moved back here. Those are potentially good jobs. It's dirty work, but it could and should pay well. And I think we're cutting corners by having all the processing done for us overseas.
Martha Mendoza, I'm wondering if you can tell us what has been the fallout, the reaction from the companies you named in your reporting this week.
First of all, nobody disputed our findings, and I think that's in large part because we had video of this, and documentation. They have had different approaches. Some want to work with the fisheries that are involved with the forced labor and see if they can use their financial power to make them change their practices, and others have simply cut off suppliers who we named in our stories.
Wow. There was at least one headline. Thailand's biggest seafood company said Wednesday it's cut ties with a supplier that you named. But what does that, what does that do if other suppliers are using similar, human trafficking practices?
Well, the Indonesian ministry, which is responsible for the island where we saw this going on, is going over there as we speak and is trying to sort out who's responsible for this labor practice and how to put an end to it. The Thai government says they will similarly crack down. They have said this in the past, and we haven't seen a lot of change. The State Department has a little bit of leverage. They gave Thailand what's called a Tier 3 rating for their trafficking in persons and human rights records. That's blacklisting them.
That puts them with North Korea, Syria, and Iran, right?
Right, exactly.
The story, the AP story is new, but slave labor in the news is not in regards to seafood. Last year, there was a big story that The Guardian broke about slave labor in the Thai shrimp industry, which is, I think, Martha, if I'm correct, is what led to this downgrading to the Tier 3.
Correct.
What had been going on in Thailand, Thailand is our number one supplier of shrimp. The U.S. is the number one supplier of shrimp. But what had been going on in Thailand, if I understand the story correctly, is that in order to... very quickly. Shrimp are fed fish that are ground up, wild fish that are ground up and fed to them, and those wild fish were caught oftentimes by slaves.
So that we're talking to Paul Greenberg, Martha Mendoza, and Jackie Savitz about slavery in the fish business. What's your biggest concern, listeners? Where do you buy your fish? Are there certain types of fish you won't eat now that you've read the story from Associated Press? Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, I'll give you that number now that you have your pen at the ready, 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add your comments and questions online. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. This hour, we're talking about slavery in the fish business following an eye-opening investigative report from the Associated Press. We've got a link to the story at our website, kqed.org/forum. In the meantime, we also have on the line Martha Mendoza, co-author of the AP investigation, Paul Greenberg, writer, journalist, and author of American Catch, The Fight for our Local Seafood, and Jackie Savitz, who leads work for in the U.S. for Oceana, an international oceans preservation organization in Washington, D.C. And I guess I'll start with you, Paul Greenberg, in the second half hour with a question Christopher has emailed. Another reason to buy local, he says, and this raises the question about what consumers can do. How can I not reward the slave trade with my purchase?
Well, there are a few things. First of all, there is a kind of rising movement in this country called community-supported fisheries, or CSFs, And it's a little bit like a community-supported agriculture cooperative, where you buy a share in a local fishery at the beginning of the season, and you get a delivery of fish every week or so, depending on the agreement. There's a great website called localcatch.org. It's localcatch.org, and you can find a CSF in your city. Not all of them have them yet, but it's a really nice way to start.
And you can really trust that you're not getting fish that conceivably is not what it purports to be?
I think you can. You know, these are short supply chains. And, you know, if you're not actually meeting the fisherman in the market when you're picking up your fish, you're meeting probably his wife or her husband. So it's very, very intimate. And, you know, granted, there are not a lot of these out there, but there is certainly room to grow. And, you know, I think it's just a great, great effort.
Let's turn to the phones now, and Tanya in Menlo Park. Hi, Tanya.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I so admire this investigation that you've all done, and I'm not going to be supporting any type of fish or seafood that's caught this way.
And how do you hope to do that, Tanya?
Well, I mean, I think the community-supported fisheries, like you just mentioned, is a great way. And looking for any type of labeling on the seafood that I buy in the market to see if it's caught sustainably.
Martha Mendoza, I've got to ask you, after doing this reporting, has it just destroyed your taste for seafood?
Well, to be honest, I've been raised vegetarian, so I've never eaten seafood. But my husband and his brother wanted to have a nice dinner, and so I went to the market to buy some seafood. That was my job. And I got 2 pounds of locally caught halibut, and I paid $45 for it. And I think that might be the true cost of seafood.
What about you, Jackie Savitz? Do you avoid all seafood, or you stick to local?
I avoid certain types. I try to choose the seafood that, you know, is in the best choices, you know, on the Monterey Aquarium's list. But you can never be sure you're eating what you think you're eating, and that's the biggest problem for me. It's just frustrating for me to be in a restaurant and see the grouper special and know that it's not grouper.
Probably tilapia.
Just aren't that many groupers, tilapia or you know, Asian catfish or something like that. And you know, I always ask them, and they always say, no, we are really serving grouper, and I just wish I had that DNA test handy just to tell them, because, you know, it's just they don't know, even I don't think the servers know. And I think that's the thing that's the most disturbing to me is, am I really getting what I'm ordering, and if not, what am I supporting? And that's why we've been pushing so hard for traceability.
Where does a consumer find that list you mentioned?
The Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch Guide is a good one. They can go to the Monterey Bay Aquarium's webpage and find their Seafood Watch Guide, or just look up Seafood Watch Guide on the internet.
I should mention they also have a downloadable app you can use for on your smartphone.
That's right.
And Paul, you were about to say?
Oh, it's just the website is seafoodwatch.org.
Well, thank you so much, Tanya. Moving now to Carrie in West Marin.
Hi. My question may have been answered, but I'm also a vegetarian and don't eat fish, but I do know many people, including my boyfriend, who's become extremely picky about where the fish comes from. But our local market now puts labels on all the vegetables and fruits about where they've been, where they come from, how many miles they've come out of, where even to the point of what who the grower is. And I just wonder why that isn't applied to animals, period, in all of our food. I mean, I think what's happening in our food is fairly disgusting as it is, but this just puts a whole new, you know, thing in it. And it's just like, why do they not label where fish is caught and where it's come from? Because I don't even think half the people realize what a trip looks like for a fish, period, how far it goes and, you know, where it's turned around to be processed. And it's almost bizarre, really, what happens.
Paul Greenberg, can you speak to this question? I mean, I suppose you never really know for certain. You trust the retailer if that label says those apples came from an orchard nearby. But it seems in some strange way as if, seafood labeling, you know, can be false without anybody knowing.
It's hard. I mean, the problem is with seafood is that the supply chain is so long and it has so many rungs in it. The moment that we decided to start having our own seafood processed abroad in Asia, to me, was a major kind of disconnect. Like, it might have made sense from a dollars and cents perspective because it is much cheaper to pay a Thai fish cutter to clean squid than it is to pay somebody from Santa Monica. But, you know, you're buying into this food chain that is basically faceless. And so I think the secret here is to try and knock some rungs out of that food chain. And yes, you know, Jackie's right. It is going to be more expensive. You are going to end up paying more per pound. But, I mean, when I looked at this whole question around squid, like California market squid, which a lot of it goes abroad, I think in the end to have the squid processed here was going to add another couple bucks a pound to the squid. And that's not egregious, and that's not unreasonable. I wouldn't mind paying a couple extra pounds for squid that was processed here.
But that raises a question, right? Like, you might be paying a couple extra bucks a pound for squid you think is processed here,
right?
But it's not
right.
Actually. There was a New York Times report a while back where they did some DNA testing on the salmon that was sold, you know, and labeled as special, wild, and all of that.
Yep.
In stores as reputable as Whole Foods.
Yep. Well, I mean, we need to invest in more, you know, more infrastructure to actually look at this stuff. You need people on the ground. You need eyes on the ground. You need tests. You need more than 2% of the seafood coming into this country tested. And that all translates into people and man hours. And, you know, we just got to do it.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, Paul mentioned the Obama administration really did come out with a set of recommendations, I think it was a week or two ago,
yeah,
that if they come to pass, really might get at some of this. There's a traceability element where they would look at the highest risk seafood and mandate traceability. There's renewed interest in enforcement. The only thing I didn't see in that report was any funding for any of it.
Well, but what I did notice when you pick through it and you look at see who are the collaborating agencies, quite often it's the Department of Homeland Security, which, you know, is both interesting and a little scary because I think, you know, probably from a security point of view that all this unknown fish is coming into the country, what else unknown is coming in on boats? And so it gives the Homeland Security, you know, agency an opportunity to look into a place that they didn't normally look into.
Well, actually, this is something that the Oceana has really worked on and been behind because we were the ones that exposed a lot of the seafood fraud problem in fish, then in shrimp, and we have more to come. But I can tell you that the idea of traceability is actually not a big expensive mandate on the government. It's a mandate on the industry, and sure, it might cost the industry a little bit, but in fact, much of this catch documentation is already being collected, and fishermen already have to report their catches. They don't always do it in the most cost-effective way. With new technology, there may even be cheaper ways for them to do it. So I don't think we should look at traceability as a big expensive mandate, especially not on the government, because it doesn't really have to be that. The government makes the rules, the fish, the supply chain complies with the rules, and there's a lot of private enterprise. I just had someone in my office this morning telling me they wanted to provide the services to the government to track the data that's reported. So I just wanted to point that out. I don't think it's necessarily an expensive mandate, and it's something that clearly the public wants. I mean, we've seen more outcry about this seafood fraud problem than we've seen about just about anything, and when you add to it what Martha and her team has uncovered, it's even more so.
Yeah.
I should mention that we have also posted on our website, kqed.org/forum, a link to the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch, which is for those people who are at least trying to determine, you know, what the general word is right now on that kind of shrimp you think you see on the menu. Is it sustainable? Is it something that you should be eating if you have environmental concerns? It's quite handy. Again, that's on our website, kqed.org/forum. Rick writes, I'm willing to pay $20 plus for a pound of Alaska halibut, but wonder if these efforts to track at each step and date each caught item will drive the price out of the reach of the average consumer, pushing it into food for the elites.
Well, Jackie, said it didn't.
I don't think it does. And, you know, one thing to keep in mind, too, is that, you know, different countries have different levels of sustainability in their fishery policies. Different states have different levels of sustainability. We believe that wild fish caught in Alaska typically comes from sustainable fisheries. Wild salmon from Alaska is always a good choice. If you know it's wild, if it can be traced to demonstrate that it's wild, it's likely to be a good choice. And there's a number of companies in the U.S. that are already doing traceability voluntarily, Gulf Wild and Gulf Shrimp, for example, because they know that their product actually can command a premium when it's traceable. So, for example, if you know it's really Gulf Shrimp, or you know it's really wild Alaska salmon, or you know it's really Maryland blue crab, then you're willing to pay a little bit more. And so companies are voluntarily doing it when they see a benefit to it. And the companies that are selling us the Asian catfish, you don't get a premium for that. They're only going to do it if we make it mandatory.
Yeah, the Gulf Wild story is really interesting, because what happened there was originally fishermen were kind of being penalized in the marketplace because they were being accused of fishing in oiled waters post-BP. And so the Gulf Wild system created a traceability system where you could actually trace the fish back down to the exact place it was caught by, the exact captain it was caught by. Well, once, you know, we got this sort of oil spill thing past us, the people at Gulf Wild realized, wow, you know, now we have this way to document an authentic red snapper from a piece of tilapia coming from Thailand. And, you know, that was really kind of revolutionary. So those kinds of schemes, more and more of them, I think, are going to crop up as the years go by.
Let's take a call now. Go ahead. Yes.
I also want to say, I describe buying some very expensive fish, but I looked at a whole lot of freezer cases of fish and fresh fish doing the story, and Americans don't pay enough for their seafood, and that's the problem. Consumers are, the prices are very low. You can get, and in the big box stores, you can get a lot of seafood for a very low price. And my colleagues in Thailand were wanting me to really make that point to people in California today.
That you get what you pay for, and possibly you may get more than you bargained for. Zarni in Oakland, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for calling taking my call. And yes, I'm originally from Burma. And I had a cousin who was, back in 1992, 93, he paid a lot of money to go work in the fish shipping industries in Thailand. And he left Burma and arrived Thailand. But once we were told that he was on board, and we never heard of him again, ever.
Wow.
Until now. And now we have seen the AP footage and then the news, and it makes sense to me now. I realize that we assume that he's killed, he's dead, but because he's not the person like who disappeared just like that. Now it makes sense to me that he's probably one of the victims that end up in that island, I know, or in the sea, in this abuse. And I believe that it's also the local governments from Thailand or even in Burma, and are also corrupt. And not only that, the industries that we are monitoring it, but also local government also has to be involved. And then I believe that if local governments are not involved, then we should put sanction on the government that is involved. It's like Thai government or Malaysian government or Burmese government. I mean, the human rights abuses are everywhere in Thailand, especially labor migrants' labor abuses, shrimp industry, fishing industries, and even in refugee camps, there's abuses by the Thai local police.
Well, that's a good question you raised, Zarni, and I put it to our panel. I mean, what can be done beyond just sort of, you know, issuing sanctions or issuing embarrassing statements to pressure these countries to take the lives of their citizens more seriously?
Yeah, I mean, I can throw in one idea on that, and it goes back to the point you mentioned earlier about Secretary Kerry's involvement. And really, these countries that are major importers, like the U.S. and like the European Union, which is more than one country, obviously, are major importers, and we can actually sanction countries by essentially saying we won't import your fish if you can't prove that your fishing practices are are legal, at least. And, you know, that could be extended to these types of behaviors as well, to basically say, if it says Thailand, it's not coming in until you show us that you fixed this problem, or if it says, you know, a country that, that we know we're starting to see these problems in, and really put the pressure on that country to clean up its act.
Martha Mendoza, does that strike you as a feasible strategy?
You know, there's many pronged approaches that that we've been discussing today that can push toward a solution. Zarni's story is absolutely tragic, and it really underscores why this stuff matters so much.
Zarni, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And gosh, yeah, I guess you're not holding out any hope at this point.
If I could just add one last thing, that it's not like we in the United States don't have any other alternative. Like, say we say we don't want any fish coming to us from Thailand. One thing a lot of people don't realize is we export a tremendous amount of fish. This country exports about a third of what we catch, about 3 billion pounds every single year. If that fish were to stay here, that could do a lot towards getting us out of these tricky moral situations.
Sort of redirecting our market tastes for fish.
Exactly.
Aaron in Sausalito, thank you for joining us.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So, I was actually, I had a question for Ms. Mendoza and anyone who wants to comment. I graduated from California Maritime Academy in Vallejo focused on global studies, and we spent a lot of time trying to track the fishing industry and discussing, you know, issues within that. But we're pretty much relegated to looking on the internet, and I'm really interested on her sort of investigative journalism. Like, what types of thoughts or techniques does she recommend? I mean, not everyone has the sort of resources to take a year off, but I was really interested to shed any comments on that.
Martha?
Yeah, sure. This is the kind of thing that the Associated Press is uniquely able to do, and we have done similar stories with gold from Congo or child labor, illegal child labor. We have reporters in just about, or stringers in just about every country in the world, and that means we have the languages and the cultural ability to be comfortable in all these countries and communicate with people. When our Burmese-speaking reporter was noticed on an Indonesian island, people began calling to her, you know, Burma, Burma, and wanted to tell her their story. Even other government officials had gone and seen people, but being unable to speak their language or put them at ease to speak their language had not quite comprehended how bad things were. So in terms of the investigative reporting, it's both complicated in that you have to have a lot of people who have video cameras and cameras and can ask questions, but it's also a matter of we're uniquely fortunate to be able to be in the right places at the right time.
That's a fabulous question. Thank you so much, Aaron. One listener emails, here's how you can avoid buying slave-caught seafood. Buy your fish from a reputable local fisherman, i.e., and he provides some suggestions here, Real Good Fish of Moss Landing and local farmers markets, etc. Carmen emails, I find it maddening there isn't a local fish market to buy local fish from local fishermen in San Francisco. Fisherman's Wharf is just a place for cruise ships and chain restaurants, something you've complained about, Paul Greenberg.
I mean, one of the things that's really that I came across in my research was that in the last 30 years, the shift in the fish business from the local fishmonger to the supermarket has been really marked. Like, it used to be something like 70-80% of the fish trade was controlled by local fishmongers and 20-30% in supermarkets. Now it has completely flipped, like 20% fishmongers, 80% big supermarkets. And, you know, okay, big supermarkets, you're going to take over the supply chain, but are you going to be responsible about it? I mean, you certainly have the funding and the money to do it, but if you're going to make our seafood faceless, then you have to be able to provide the backup that, you know, you trust it and that it is in a good state of supply and not, you know, sourcing from illegal sources.
But isn't it true that there are seafood distributors, like the one we were mentioning earlier this hour? It's not just the big supermarkets. It's
true.
You know, small restaurants, small retailers are pulling from the same short list of distributors.
True. That's true.
The one point is that I'm not I'm not opining on it at this point because I don't know enough about it, but there's plenty of extremely impoverished people who are depending on American dollars in these developing countries to buy their seafood. And so, you know, people say buy local, and I completely understand that, and I look at the environmental, social and political costs of moving fish around the world so much, but there is that other factor.
A listener writes, Americans enjoy the products of slavery in their iPhones, their chocolate, coffee, sugar. Do you really think that people will care about slave labor-provided fish?
I think what happened in the situation and what needs to continue happening, unfortunately, is that we have to go find these people and humanize them until people do start to care and change starts to happen. And I mean, there's so much work already being done in this direction, but in this particular situation, I think people literally needed an image of somebody in a cage to say, oh, right, that's what human trafficking is.
That is not okay. Let's go now to Terry in Sebastopol.
Yeah. The fish we're talking about is really kind of toxic to human bodies. We really shouldn't be eating fish. Dr. Chelsea Roachman has found that all fish tested. She could not find any fish that did not test positive protective chemicals. Stones from the plastics that are in all of the oceans. So
let's put that question to our panel. Is there an argument to be made that for health reasons alone, we should just basically let go of seafood entirely?
I guess I'll take that one, even though it's a
Jackie
tricky
Savitz,
one.
Yeah,
I mean, Oceana is an advocate of eating fish, but eating fish responsibly, and we believe that the wild seafood actually has the potential to actually help us address hunger issues around the world, because we can actually bring back fish populations and do it in a way that actually has a lot of benefits over land-based livestock production. And not to get into too much detail about that, but we think there's a lot of potential to address the growing population's need for food. That said, I think, you know, we have to be eat fish responsibly as well in choosing our fish, and we can avoid a lot of the potential toxics issues by eating low on the food chain, small fish. And small fish is something that has been sort of underappreciated over the years. Fish like anchovies and sardines, assuming they're caught sustainably, actually are very good food. And they don't build up toxics in the food chain the way something like a tuna does. You know, it's interesting when you look at food chains, because fish, high food chain fish, are really the only sort of fifth or sixth trophic level species that we eat. Cows eat grass, chickens eat grain, fish, some fish eat fish that ate other fish, and so on down the chain. And so what that means is that every step in the food chain, some of these chemicals biomagnify, bioaccumulate, and biomagnify, and we get millions of times more exposure in a high food chain fish than we would get in a small fish. And so eat small, eat local. These are all good pieces of advice that we can take away from.
And I might also add that when we abandon the ocean as a food source, then it just becomes a waste disposal system.
Isn't it already one?
Well, it is, but I mean, I think that if we were to build a greater connection to seafood, I mean, keep in mind, even though we do import a lot of seafood in this country, we only eat about 15 pounds per person per year compared to 200 pounds of land food meats. So I think a greater reliance on the ocean as a food source would cause us, I think, to start looking at things like big coal that is, you know, causing the methylation of mercury and causing a lot of that to go into our seafood supply. So, you know, let's think about the seafood system as a holistic thing that we need to keep clean and that we also need to keep morally correct.
Hunter in Sebastopol, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What question would you like to ask?
Oh, first I'd like to know when the last time any of you had any tuna or clam chowder, because most of that is not handled by U.S.
That's a good question. Anyone want to answer that one?
I can speak to tuna and clam chowder.
Martha
which is
Mendoza,
that I, again, I don't eat it. But Thai Union, which is one of the companies we tied this slave-caught seafood to, owns Chicken of the Sea, is buying Bumblebee, and does about $3.5 billion a year in sales, and recently was the first Thai company to make it onto the Dow Jones Industrial Sustainability Index. So yes, if your point is that tuna is a big issue here, I agree.
Does that answer your question, Hunter?
Tuna. No, really. My point was that we all want to eat tuna and we all want to eat clam chowder. But you're telling us basically that you're going to ask us to stop protein sources without offering us an alternative. As vegetarians and maybe PETA members, are you? Any of you PETA members?
I'm a fish eater and not a vegetarian. But, I mean, I do think that there are many kinds of seafood that we can eat that are both, clean from a toxicological point of view and clean from a moral point of view. When I source my seafood locally. I eat things like mussels.
Very quickly, Paul.
Which are mussels, very high in omega-3s, very, very good seafood. And you can find these things, but you have to work at it.
You have to work at it. Well, thank you for your point there, Hunter. And thank you, Paul Greenberg, writer and journalist, author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Jackie Savitz, Vice President for U.S. Oceans for Oceana and International Oceans Preservation Organization. And Martha Mendoza, co-author of the investigation by the Associated Press, Finding Widespread Slavery in the Fish Business in Southeast Asia. We've got a link to that story online. Please check it out at kqed.org/forum. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.